Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning. I mean, good afternoon.
Good almost. It's still morning.
Good day, Beth Ann.
And hello to you, too.
You know, I think that's probably the best way to go. We're still obviously adjusting to our time change, but we're also adjusting to something far more serious today, the announcement in the paper this morning.
Right. This morning, we woke to the news that the Department of Homeland Security had released deportation rules derived from President Trump's executive orders on immigration and border security. The change of whether they change the enforcement priorities, and they include the removal of undocumented people convicted of a crime, any crime, not just serious crime, as had been the policy in the Obama administration. Now, congregations around North America from many faiths are promoting a sanctuary movement in response. So what about Hawaii? While there's been talk, are Hawaii congregations taking any actions on behalf of illegals here? We called Reverend David Gerlach, no stranger to social justice issues, and he's in our studio now. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning to you. Thank you for having me.
As you understand the term sanctuary city, what does that mean, just for clarity's sake?
As I understand it, it means that cities aren't going to actively cooperate with the federal government in identifying undocumented persons in their city. So that unless somebody commits a serious crime, their status in this country is not something that the local police are going to concern themselves with.
That may be changing under these new rules, the whole issue of crime, as we just talked about in the opening. But we should also, for clarity's sake, say that Hawaii is not a sanctuary city.
No, although I think as a practical matter, I think our police department has adopted that kind of policy where they're not looking at someone's immigration status as part of traffic stops or other kind of incidental interactions with law enforcement.
If that changes, then we will have a whole other issue to be talking about. But as you have been talking to those in the faith community now and looking at all the other issues that have to do with not just turning someone in, but really protecting someone,
right,
the whole notion of sanctuary that was offered to those who would walk into churches, you know, for hundreds of years. Is that, in fact, what you and those in the faith community are talking about?
Yes, indeed. In fact, just last Friday, over 40 people from many different congregations gathered at the Quaker's house in Manoa to discuss exactly this issue. And there are a number of congregations across denominational lines that are actively discussing identifying themselves as sanctuary sites.
And whereas you don't want to necessarily identify them now until they're ready to identify themselves, what specifically are you talking about in saying, yes, we're a sanctuary site? What would you do for someone who might come knocking on your door?
Well, you know, the big issue here for me is what does it mean to be church? And for far too many years, what it's meant to be church is basically to practice a kind of American civil religion where we worship God and the bomb and apple pie all in the same breath. But I think what's happening, particularly in these stressful times, when for many of us it has eerie echoes of the 1930s with so much hatred and vitriol and people in positions of great power setting people against each other, is are we people who admire Jesus or are we people who follow him? And it was Pastor Bonhoeffer, the famous Lutheran pastor who was arrested and killed by the Hitler regime, who said that as Christians, we don't have a choice in these matters. The choice has been made for us already. The question is whether we will do what we are required to do. And we are required as Christians to welcome the stranger, to protect the alien, and to care for the vulnerable in our midst. To not do those things or to support legislation and laws that are opposed to those is not to be Christian.
We may think of ourselves in the United States as being those who follow Judeo-Christian background of various different types. But in practical terms, we have lots of people here from many different traditions. We have many Muslims in the United States. We have others who have come who are Baha'i, who are Buddhist, who are Hindu, And we tend to focus on this idea of sort of the Judeo-Christian way of looking at things, not necessarily that tradition as being the one and only. How broad-based is this idea of becoming sanctuary and networking those communities together nationally and perhaps here in Hawaii too already?
I think all of the great faith traditions all share that common belief that we need to look out for the most vulnerable. It cuts across interreligious lines. And our Muslim brothers and sisters here have been quite active, and we have worked closely with them in opposing, for example, the recent ban on folks coming from different countries in the Middle East and Africa. Our Buddhist brothers and sisters have been extremely involved for many, many years in these very kinds of issues. So yeah, I expect this to be very broad-based. And the closer it gets to home, I think the more activity we'll see.
Is this setting up church against state?
It may, and that's an appropriate place for the church to be. We are called, I can only speak from my Christian tradition, but we are called to be witnesses to the kingdom of God. Well, if God's got a kingdom, it's naturally going to bump up against the kingdom that we, in our best thinking, come up with. Because with us, we somehow manage to have fantastic income inequality. We manage to have never-ending wars. And we somehow manage to find ways to be antagonistic with each other. And all of that is completely anathema to the kingdom of God.
In Hawaii, we tend to think that we are different from folks on the mainland. We have a different population, certainly. We are geographically the most remote place from any place else. As we talk to ourselves in this conversation and then also speak to those who are throughout North America, even today with Montreal saying that it's also a sanctuary city, although there have been really no benefits appropriated to be able to help in that regard. But as we have these conversations in the micro and the macro sense, what is it that you think that we really need to focus on in making those actions self-evident and not just conversation?
Well, I think in Hawaii, we can be and are a real role model for much of the rest of the United States. It seems that so much of what's being driven right now is based on fear from my age group and my ethnicity. You know, older white men are scared, it seems. And yet here in Hawaii, we've shown that we can live with majority-minority populations very well with each other and get along and learn with from each other and grow with each other. I think that is a witness to the mainland. And for the rest of it, we'll just have to see. It seems that these immigration efforts are being targeted primarily at folks from Mexico and Central America. Our largest group of undocumented people are from the Philippines and Japan. One wonders how much of this is just racist and race-directed, and we'll have to see how difficult ICE gets with the undocumented here in Hawaii.
Because our populations are so different, as you just said, that efforts on the mainland looking more to those who are Hispanic, Mexican, Central American, and we here have such a different population, do you think that brings us closer or causes more reason to feel more removed from what's happening on the mainland?
I think it's probably some of both, quite frankly. We are far away, and in some ways that can be a real, it can be distressing. That we don't have the impact maybe that our actions over here would have if we were all in Indiana or something like that. But we are where we are, and we need to do what we need to do here in our own place.
Do you have an estimate that you consider to be a very good estimate of how many undocumented folks there are in Hawaii?
My understanding is there's somewhere around 20,000.
Not exactly a drop in the bucket.
It's not. It accounts for, I believe, about 1.4% of our total population, which is still a significant number of human beings.
So when you're talking about what would you do for those people, what are you prepared to do for them should the need arise? And should these rules, in fact, mean that someone who might have shoplifted or, you know, committed fraud on some paperwork and suddenly is now in the crosshairs of immigration officials?
Yeah, my own sense is that within the next several months, there's going to be at least a dozen dozen churches in our state who identify themselves as sanctuaries, which would be different than how a city is a sanctuary. If a church serves as a sanctuary, that means somebody who is at risk of being deported would come and live at the church and remain at the church. And we would challenge the federal officials whether they really want to come on holy ground and take away a family member for something that is along the lines that you've just described.
What you've just said is that, you know, holy ground could become a battleground.
But the battle will be fought with non-resistance, non-violence, and with love and compassion, not only for those who are being housed, but for those who are attempting to take them.
We talked a little earlier about the meeting that you had on Friday among several denominations. Have you also reached out to, you know, police officials and others who might be instrumental in aiding the cause?
That hasn't happened yet. I'm sure that is something that will occur.
What would you ask them to do?
Primarily to continue what they are doing. I don't think anybody objects that if an individual is undocumented and has committed a violent crime or a very serious crime that causes serious injury, that that person probably shouldn't be here. But that's not the vast majority. And the vast majority simply contribute to our society, pay taxes for benefits they often don't receive because they're not eligible, and are contributing members of our community. We are, after all, a society based and built on immigration.
Are you at all concerned that some who might come through might cause disruption here in a way that we haven't seen? Immigrants, you know, because we mostly when we talk to officials who say, look, you know, we don't have any real documented cases of in Hawaii and just in general of having those who come through the immigration channels causing disruption, that in fact they come and they do quite the opposite, that they are trying to fit in, they're trying to repay a country that's given them an opportunity.
Absolutely.
But in this case where there is so much fear, you know, that whole miasma of fear and anger and angst that you talked about earlier, are you at all concerned that the scopes on all of those things will cause more of it, or that might, you know, breed some of it in a way that we haven't seen?
I don't know that people are going to react in that kind of way to the scrutiny. I worry that people are going to be driven underground. So I worry when I hear reports of a woman, for example, who is a victim of domestic abuse and doesn't report it to the police because she's undocumented. And then we find out that the perpetrator actually reported her as undocumented. So that is what's frightening. And I think that's what concerns, frankly, our local law enforcement, that they want the cooperation of our undocumented community so that crimes like that that occur don't go into the deep background.
With the fear that is taking many different shapes, I mean, certainly there were so many people who never even believed that Donald Trump could get elected president and spoke as if, you know, not at first dismissively, and then, you know, we all know what we saw last year. But it certainly made a group of people surface that we all now look at, and although you probably wouldn't put yourself in that position, although you might call yourself an older white male, why do you think this group of people has been so nasty, and how much vitriol, you know, we've seen from them in ways that we hadn't seen in past because they perhaps were so deeply underground, and now that they are above ground, are you concerned for what other damage they might be able to do?
I think that there's a percentage of folks who supported Mr. Trump who are from that category that you've described, the KKK folks and the David Dukes. But I think there's far more who are afraid, who have themselves felt that they've been left behind. As income inequality has gotten completely out of control, where 75 human beings have as much wealth as 3.5 billion other people on this planet, I think that fear generated a lot of his support. And that's always a regrettable thing because fear leads to opposing people against people. And it doesn't really attack the primary issue, which is, where's all the money going? Well, it's going to people like Mr. Trump and his pals and the folks that he's appointed to his cabinet, which is made up of a majority of billionaires. I think that's where the real problem is. And maybe we need to step back and take a look at that, that the problem isn't my African American neighbor or my undocumented Mexican neighbor who's just working to feed a family. It's people like Bill Gates, who, God bless him, does a lot with his money. But why does any human being need $62 billion? I think those are the questions we need to be asking.
The income inequality issue is a big one for you, and I understand that. But the idea of fear that has to be perpetuated needs fuel.
Yes, it does.
And so what do you see as being the fuel for that fear in a way that perhaps we haven't seen it?
I think it's an old story. It's by falsely setting up scapegoats in the community so that you can blame somebody who, in fact, is not blameworthy, while the people who are whistle past the graveyard. And I think that's what's happening today. We're looking at illegal immigrants as a cause of our problems, when in fact the real problems is we have too many billionaires and not enough equitable sharing of the wealth that everybody contributes to and everybody helps generate.
There would be some who would say, well, if this is a meritocracy and people who have earned on their own or through their own intellectual capabilities what they have, how do you put that into the context of, you know, sort of the American dream if you say that there are some who have far too much? Who's to say who has too much?
I think that's the big lie, because what has happened over the last 30 years is that we've got a group at the very top who only deal with each other. And so they sit on each other's boards of directors and they approve each other's executive compensation at rates 300 times the average worker's pay, and they serve each other. That is something that is relatively new in this country. From World War II until the late 70s, we had an expanding middle class. Since the 70s, the 80s, the so-called Reagan Revolution that even the Democratic Party bought into in many ways, we've had this confiscation of wealth by the wealthy, and that can be changed.
That sort of confiscatory way of being and the disconnect that it represents, how do you see that happening in Hawaii if you do?
Well, part of it is a lot of the work that we're doing to get affordable housing built, for example, and to have developers be required to have to build 20% of their units as affordable. These are things that help people move, you know, improve the benefit of their life and the quality of their life.
So just to short circuit this a little bit in the interest of time, because we're going to have to say goodbye in a moment, although we may not be a sanctuary city or a sanctuary state, from what I hear you say, that idea of sanctuary has to be brought into the fabric of daily living. And if there are challenges to those who are here and living as illegal immigrants, that the faith community will be willing to stand up and, in, if it has to, go against government.
Yes, indeed. That is what we are commanded to do by the one that we claim to follow. So, yes, we will do so.
Reverend David Gerlach, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Reverend David Gerlach is an Episcopal priest, a retired trial lawyer of 20-some-odd years' experience, and he's currently the sitting per diem family court judge. He is the rector of St. Elizabeth's Episcopal Church in Paloma.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Ivory Coast vocalist and dancer Dobe Nahore in a performance of world music, 7:30 p.m. this Thursday at Castle Theater, mauiarts.org.
This week on This American Life, the story of two babies switched at birth. And this isn't one of those stories where nobody knows for years and it's only discovered after searching and painstaking detective work. No, no. One of the moms knew from the very beginning. She kept it a secret for 43 years. And then she told everybody this week.
Hear This American Life, Saturday at 1 p.m.
Oh, Mom, tell me it wasn't you. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, We're going to talk about the Mahele Natural Farm. And first, though, your backyard quiz.
It's currently the off-season for Major League Baseball, but today's backyard quiz will give you some relief. Before the construction of Aloha Stadium in 1975, Honolulu Stadium served as the city's premier sports venue. Located at the corner of Eisenberg and King Streets, the stadium hosted a wide range of events like concerts, football, and baseball games. And in April of 1944, one member of the New York Yankees arrived in Hawaii to join the 7th Army Air Force's baseball team during a brief tournament hosted in the islands. In one game, this Yankee player belted a towering 435-foot home run, which flew over the park's fence and all the way onto Eisenberg Street. And although his team ultimately lost the tournament, the Yankee had won a considerable amount of new local fans. For our quiz this morning, can you name this famous New York Yankee who hit that long ball? If you can, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. If you're the first one to get it right, we'll hit an HPR prize all the way to your mailbox.
Aloha, I'm Chris Charbonneau from Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
As more and more young people turn to agriculture, they're looking back in time at farming methods from long ago, turning away from so-called modern farming methods in favor of well-tested methods that have been neglected down through the years. Seth Robb, farm manager of Mahele Farm in Hana, a community farm in East Maui, is certified in Korean natural farming. He's teaching a workshop in Hana this weekend, and he's on the line from his farm. Good morning, Seth.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, it's I'm seeing a youth movement in agriculture. Is that an accurate perception?
Oh, absolutely. There's definitely a lot of young people these days that are looking at the big picture and seeing the trends in how we're degrading our environment and producing food that's not healthy and doing it unsustainably, and people are looking to the past in many different angles to try to learn ways to grow food sustainably.
You know, you might think, if you didn't know better, you might think that young people would be all about the latest technology and how it applies to farming, and, you know, the latest methods rather than ancient methods. It seems counterintuitive to me. How do you explain that?
Well, I can't say exactly why there is this movement, but I think in general young people are very literate technologically.
Yeah.
Just naturally growing up with it.
Sure.
But I think the movement towards sustainable agriculture and natural farming and these traditional methods is something beyond a trend. I think it's something that people are inherently discovering about humanity, that we really need to get back on track in terms of working with nature rather than against it.
So it isn't necessarily inconsistent with youth and the embrace of technology in a number of ways.
Yeah, no. In a lot of cases, there's a union of modern technology and traditional farming methods that people are finding. You know, you can look on social media and find a lot of people that are really stoked on traditional farming, for instance.
And that sort of implies to me, Seth, that a lot of perfectly good methods have been abandoned over the years. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah, what has mainly been abandoned are methods that require human power, methods that require time, and methods that require a lot of diversity in the environment. Mm-hmm. These are all things that are counter a monoculture type of farming, mm-hmm. with big machines, large scale, and it makes all those things a little bit more difficult when you have to pay attention to the environment, see what bugs are showing up, see what your crop is deficient in, maybe harvesting different things at different times. These are all inefficiencies that have been, you know, basically thrown out of the system in favor of large scale. But then you have bigger problems with pests and disease and, soil erosion.
Mm-hmm. Yet it strikes me that single crop agriculture, I keep hearing that it depletes the land, and the method seems to have been in years past to replenish replenish the land with artificial means in order to keep pumping out a high output of whatever crop it is you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of what used to be done, and that's the thing that you folks are moving away from?
Yeah, and it's definitely still done on the large part. It's easy. It's easy to buy a bag of fertilizer and buy a pesticide and put it in the ground and spray it. But in the long term, it's not sustainable. And that's what, you know, that's one of the things that lots of people, not just young people, are realizing in a broader perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different thing to be on the ground as a farmer and to have to transition from growing a monocrop to doing things diversely and organically. And that's something we do need to realize, those of us who are part of this movement, is that we need to be supportive of farmers who are making an effort to go in that direction and not just, you know, shaming them.
Because they might be dealing with depleted land that has to be replenished in one way or the other, right?
Absolutely, yeah. They're on the ground dealing with the reality of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Why Korean natural farming? And that's you're certified in that particular study. What is it about the Korean methods that makes them so valuable?
Well, I'm a student of many many farming philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
Korean natural farming is one that showed up. Master Cho Hankyu, who is the founder of Korean natural farming, he gave a five-day workshop in Hilo back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And I read something about it, something about one of the preparations in it, and it reminded me of something that I learned when I was an agriculture student studying abroad in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
There was this method that the coffee farming family that I lived with had for controlling a fungus on their coffee, and it was really similar to a preparation that was in that Master Cho taught, and that immediately sparked my interest. I went and attended the workshop, and from then on, I was hooked.
What's a sort of a capsule description of the method? Now, obviously, using organic materials to deal with the issues you face, but how would you kind of describe it?
So fundamentally, Korean natural farming is a method of farming, definitely not the only one, but it's a method of farming where you're working in harmony with nature. This includes how you feed the plants, how you feed the soil, and then also the overall system of the farm, and how you rotate your crops, how you treat your animals, how you treat the plants. It's all about working with nature. What some of the methods that it uses to do this are traditional oriental methods of fermentations and extracts. Now, this is something that to me was really fascinating because Korea, China, Japan, you know, the East as a whole has this rich, long history of being able to do these masterful things with fermentation and extraction of different compounds for different uses, whether it's medicine or whatnot.
But you're definitely staying away from the lab and chemicals.
Yes, these are all methods that can be done at home, in your garage, in your kitchen, with common household ingredients.
That should be encouraging to a great many people. Seth, thanks for taking the time, and good luck with the workshop you're doing this weekend. Thank you.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Seth Robb is the farm manager of Mahele Farm in Hana, a community farm in East Maui. He's certified in Korean natural farming, and he's one of the instructors for a two-day Korean natural farming workshop this Saturday and Sunday at Kahanu Garden in Hana, Maui.
A group of scientists and officials says that whales can coexist with humans, including fishermen and tourists. The increased odds rely on vigilance. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we're talking about how this integrated effort among state and federal scientists, law enforcement, government officials, all of that is really upping the ante for how these whales can survive and live peacefully, even with all of us kind of, poking around trying to see them or worse, doing them damage.
Yeah, right. This is called Operation Kohola Guardian, Kohola being Hawaiian for whale, and it involves the U.S. Coast Guard, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, NOAA, the Department of Land and Natural Resources, and they have come together to, you use the word vigilance, that's exactly what they're doing. We sent our Nathan Eagle and Landis Kearns over to South Maui last week, and they got on a Coast Guard boat called the Galveston Island, a cutter, and they patrolled the waters to see the operation up front, and it really involves making sure not only that the whales are safe, that boats are maintaining a distance, you're required to stay 100 yards away, but also making sure that humans don't get involved as well. We can be in fast boats and moving in places that we shouldn't. We also want to see what's going on and watch those breaches as close as we can. But remember, we're talking about 6,000-pound creatures as well as their calves breaching and spouting water. And we have to be careful because these are dangerous times. Remember, this is whale season right now, about November to March. Usually it's a time period.
So with the vigilance that they're trying to promote, it seems that it's one thing when you're there with a group of scientists and law enforcement and officials and people who are watching out for the whales. But what about on an average day? How is this being translated into what happens when you have boatloads of tourists out there or other people who may be going, speeding along in another
right.
craft?
Well, I mean, the good news is that there's 12,000 whales, humpbacks, in the region. And, of course, they've been removed from the endangered species list. That happened last year. So that's something we're celebrating. But the flip side is a lot of people want to see those whales. And so we do have some more good news to report. Boat strikes are down. Boats running into each other, running into whales. That is significantly dropped, as well as whales getting tied up, entangled in fish nets, much less than they used to, marine debris in general. But, the whales themselves, they're intelligent creatures, and they're also curious, and they want to see what the humans are doing. So we're fortunate that there's been no incidents so far this year of any serious problems involving the whales and humans. But, the Coast Guard and others are keeping a vigil to make sure that, we don't cross the line, and some of the whales don't cross the line either.
Well, hopefully those lines will stay drawn, but peacefully and in a way which we can all observe each other and that those whales will not become entangled or struck by boats. Thanks very much for at least some good news for today.
Hey, that's a nice thing to end on. Thanks,
we
Beth.
We need it, and we get it where we can. Thanks very much, Chad. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring Chad Blair.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele, inviting you to tune in this weekend for our Prairie Home Companion with our guests Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats, Miss Aeneas Mitchell, and a bit of humor from John Hodgman. The Royal Academy of Radio Actors will be there, Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and Fred Newman, along with our resident staff critic, Mr. Bertrand Falstaff-Heine, plus our first call radio players, Sarah Jarosz, and my Song of the Week.
Here are Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evening at 6. Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Earlier this morning, we went back in time to Hawaii's original premier sports venue. Back then, in the days before Aloha Stadium, Honolulu Stadium was the only show in town. It was, and still is, located in the Mo'ili'ili district of Honolulu. In 1944, a member of the New York Yankees traveled to Hawaii to take part in a military-sponsored baseball tournament. And although that Yankees team lost that tourney, this man was able to gain fame with locals when he belted a 435-foot home run out of the park and onto Eisenberg Street. For our quiz, we asked you to name this baseball player, and the answer is Jolton Joe DiMaggio. After hitting the home run, DiMaggio developed a large fan base in Hawaii.
And Beth Ann, a number of members of that fan base called in. The first to call with the right answer was Boyd Bond of Kohala on the Big Island. But we got calls from Hilo, Maui, and Honolulu, and all in celebration of the Yankee Clipper, Joe DiMaggio.
I want to know about the Jolton part. That part.
Well,
he was
known to hit the long ball, among other things.
Well, that too.
So that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Sean Anderson from Green Rose Farm. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
The skills of the recording studio musician were once confined to a highly specialized few, mostly based in large cities. But that was before professional quality sound recording was brought within nearly everyone's reach. You don't need much more than a laptop these days to get a studio sound, but acquiring the skills the studio demands, that's another story. Jeremy Lowy, middle school band teacher at Mid-Pacific Institute, and along with the school's orchestra teacher, have combined to offer a studio music class that has already given their students a bit of a creative jolt. And Jeremy's with us in our studio to tell us how it works. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, you can, and I speak from experience, you can think you're a pretty accomplished musician, and then you get into a recording studio and the red light comes on and somebody points a finger at you through the glass, and you might not think you're such a good musician after a while.
Right. It's completely different, right? You practice, and then when you go in front of that camera and your friend presses the record button, it's a different game.
Yeah. For one thing, you're hearing a metronomic click in your ears, and you might race ahead of the beat or lag behind the beat. And you might do that habitually and not know it till you're in the studio.
And that's
right?
a difficult thing to do, to stay with the beat. A lot of students, and even myself, I think I can stick with the click track, but it's tough.
And you're a percussionist.
I'm a percussionist, yeah. So at church, when we play music, we have the click track in our ears too, and
that was
the strangest thing for me at first, but I got used to it. But it's a good skill for the students to develop to play with the click track.
Sure, because, I mean, you've got to have – something's got to keep everybody together, right?
Right. Especially if you're doing video as well, mm-hmm. right? If you're trying to sync up audio and video, the audio has to be perfectly in sync if you're layering different sections.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I hear of back in the day, in the early days of recording technology, when the Beatles recorded, they would sometimes physically splice tape from different takes of songs.
Right.
And somehow miraculously they sounded as if they were all at the same tempo, but that's nearly impossible, isn't it?
Yes, it's really hard to do. And fortunately, the students have the technology where they don't have to physically cut any tape or do any of those kinds of things. So at Mid-Pacific, since everyone has an iPad or some of them have their own laptops, mm-hmm. makes it really easy for them to have access to technology to cut their own music, to edit their own music, and produce their own music.
And these are the kind of things, and one of the reasons I think playing in a studio is so difficult was that it took a lot of money and time to even get to one. So you didn't know what the challenges were until you'd already been faced with them.
Now
you can deal with those challenges on your own, kind of.
Right, on their phone even, mm-hmm. right? Their phone has so many capabilities, their iPads, and they have access to the technology to create studio-like recordings. They don't have to face some of those huge costs.
Well, what are the things that you do with students to sort of, you know, break them into this range of skills?
Well, the studio music course, it ranges from middle school through high school. So mm-hmm. it depends on what grade level you're at. But at the middle school level, they're introduced to basic percussion skills and basic keyboard skills and basic vocal skills. And we cover a whole range of topics. That's the beauty of this new course, mm-hmm. is that it provides us flexibility and it's modular. So we can cover a whole range of topics. Just depending on what the students' interests are.
Yeah. Jeremy, we've got a sample of a rap tune that you folks created in the studio. Let's listen to that for just a second.
Wake up in the morning, put my clothes on. Uniform, now we go. Son, go to school and see all my friends. 7 periods until the day ends. First 3 periods of the day are science, learning, arts, and P.E.O.K. But these are 3 out of 7. The day has just begun, and now we're in heaven. Wake up in the morning, put my clothes on. Uniform, now we go. Son, go to school and see all my friends. 4 periods until the day ends.
Well, Jeremy, they say write about what you know, and that's clearly what these kids did, right? Get up in the morning, put my clothes on.
Right. It was pretty catchy. And that was by a seventh grader.
Really?
Seventh grader, Justin. Yes. Yeah. So they had to create their own rap, and the subject had to be about Mid-Pacific and what their day is like. And so they had to create their own beat, their own bass, their own drum line, mm-hmm. right? And then they had to compose their own lyrics as well.
Creating the beat in a computer with a drum program?
With their iPad. So they use GarageBand and they use various apps to create their own beats. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we learn how to read rhythm, notate rhythm, just like any other music class, like band or orchestra.
Sure.
But we do it without the typical instruments, without the traditional instruments, right? Without the flute in their hand or without the violin in their hand. Mm-hmm. And instead they have the iPad, which is a great tool, which is a great vehicle for teaching these kinds of concepts.
Well, you can, for example, you can have a screen that has the bass drum, the snare drum, the mm-hmm. hi-hat, and just mm-hmm. tap with your hand, you know, boom, boom, bop, boom, and get a beat out of that.
They get a beat, and then they do that with a click track to make sure they're on tempo, so they learn about tempo. And then the great thing about the iPads or electronic music is that quantize button, which shifts everything to make it perfectly in sync with the click track, and mm-hmm. then they're good to go.
Well, because you're recording to a program called Pro Tools, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of the industry standard, mm-hmm. and in Pro Tools you have practically an infinite number of channels, tracks.
Correct.
But you can also see very clearly when you play something and record it. Say if the drum beat, you know, every other drum beat becomes a sharp vertical line
right.
in one of the tracks, you can see when you record your thing along with the drum beat, mm-hmm. whether or not you're in sync. It's very clear.
It's very clear. Yeah, yeah. The visuals definitely help.
It can be pretty humbling, can't it?
Yes, yeah. All the recording experience is very humbling. They also, along with Pro Tools, they use Acapella, this app for the iPad where they layer different video and audio on top of each other.
Uh-huh.
And so they don't have the – actually, they just updated it so you can see the waveform on the app, but – to hear your voice layering on top of each other, that's also, yeah, very humbling to see, oh, that note was out of tune or that rhythm was incorrect. They can very easily see how good their time is.
But you can also, it makes it very easy to correct as well, doesn't it?
Right. Delete, record again.
just kind of think about it. You might sort of assume that you're doing okay and mm-hmm. But you get a snapshot of when you're not doing okay.
Right.
But I do think it's more readily fixed when that happens.
Yes, yeah, yeah. They are able to fix it a little bit more readily. It's a process that takes often a lot longer than they anticipate.
Mm-hmm.
Even a one-minute recording, they think, we can get this.
They'll be out of there in 10 minutes, right?
Right. They're in this, in the recording studio for a long time.
Well, sometimes life throws us these humbling experiences, right, Jeremy?
Correct.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Jeremy Lowy is the middle school band teacher at Mid-Pacific Institute, which runs studio music classes in tandem with high school orchestra teacher Elton Masaki. And you can see a video of the class on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, the movie industry has become increasingly reliant on visual effects, which must be great news for the visual effects industry in Los Angeles, right?
We had just received this Academy Award, and I worked for a company that at that time was going through a bankruptcy.
The topsy-turvy economics of Hollywood production. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Sunday morning at 11.
Aloha, I'm Tim Vandeveer from the Democratic Party of Hawaii, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There's always a great deal going on in our community, and it can be difficult to keep track. So as part of our new time slot with The Conversation here on HPR1, we're talking with our Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama, asking him to take a look at some of the events going on in the community that might just be a little bit under the radar. And Derek's with us this morning. Thanks for coming in, Derek.
Oh, of course. My pleasure.
What's cooking?
Okay. On Oahu tomorrow, contemporary fiber artist Heather McCauley will give a talk on jacquard weaving and have samples of her work. And yeah, I had to look it up.
I'm glad you did, because I was just about to ask you.
Jacquard weaves are produced on a special loom and are characterized by complex woven-in designs. And the talk is in the Honolulu Museum of Art School at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, and it's free.
That's a key word, isn't it? Free.
Yes.
It's remarkable how many events there are that are free in this community.
Yes, they all are. And the ones that I'm talking about,
yeah,
I
great.
Mean, we have the rest of them are on the Big Island tomorrow. The Kealakekua Public Library will host a presentation by Ed Fenzel on beekeeping and building natural beehives tomorrow at 5:15 p.m. He'll discuss the importance of bees and their relationship with nature and demonstrate three natural hives constructed with recycled wood.
We've been hearing a lot about the beekeeping around the islands and running into some difficulties, but also how important it is that we have bees. They're kind of at the center of everything.
Yes, yes. And, there are some endangered species, endangered bees mm-hmm. that are from Hawaii, so he might touch on that as well.
I probably will.
Also on the Big Island, the Hilo Public Library hosts a talk by Dr. Bo Reiperth from the UH Institute for Astronomy, and that's happening at 4:45. Live tomorrow, and that's free.
That's bound to provoke some discussion, isn't it, on Hawaii Island?
Yes. And OHA of East Hawaii invites the public to a free screening of Nā Hulu Lehua, the royal cloak and helmet of High Chief Kalaniʻōpuʻu. You can learn about the High Chief, the royal feather garments that he gifted to Captain Cook in 1779, and also the people who worked to return Kalaniʻōpuʻu's feather cloak and helmet back to Hawaii. That is free in the Palace Theater in Hilo tomorrow at 6.
And they are spectacular to see, aren't they?
Yes, yes. I have seen pictures of it myself.
Thanks so much, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama will be joining us each day on The Conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that go on under the radar. And you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Bethann, in your talk at the start of the show with Reverend David Gerlach, he referred to providing sanctuary as something that was not a choice, that was simply part of being a Christian, that it was not something you had to decide whether or not you were going to do, right?
And implicit in that is saying, you know, are people who say they are Christian really Christian? Is this something that they ascribe to as well? You know, some people call themselves Democrats, but they're not even members of the party.
Exactly.
So, I mean, if you use those terms, what exactly are you saying you believe in and what you will do?
Yeah.
He says that there's an implicit argument in all of this that if someone calls him or herself a Christian, that you have to be willing to do, that decision, as you say, has already been made.
And that's likely to provoke all kinds of thought on the part of that community, yeah?
Which is, again, what we're going to see, whether or not, you know, holy grounds become battlegrounds.
Yeah, exactly.
That's going to do it for us for today. sorry about that, guys. Up tomorrow, contributing editor Neil Milner will take the long view on big government.
Plus, there's yin yoga and there's yang yoga, and we'll learn the difference.
Okay. Meanwhile, you can tell us what you think about the issues and guests heard on today's show or any show. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or say hello to me at BKOZHPR.
Our conversation page is under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow with more of The Conversation.